From India's largest newsroom, I'm Arun George, and this is the Times of India podcast. The release of the controversial film Kerala Story from 2023 on national broadcaster Doordarshan just ahead of the national polls prompted criticism from the Kerala Chief Minister. This then prompted multiple churches in Kerala to declare that they would screen the film. While this move was criticized by the ruling CPM in the state as well as the Congress, which is in the opposition, not surprisingly, it was welcomed by the BJP. The BJP incidentally has been hoping to make inroads with the Christian community in Kerala in the hopes of winning Lok Sabha seats in a state it never wins in. We'd done this episode earlier when the film was released, where we discussed why the claims about ISIS and love jihad may be overstated at best. We'd also looked at why ISIS never really made inroads into India and what that tells us. We're bringing back that episode today.
ISIS kab join kiya ye janne ke liye kyun join kiya aur kaise join kiya ye janna zaruri hai.
The film titled The Kerala Story initially claimed to tell the story of 32,000 women from Kerala who were radicalized and went to join terror group Islamic State. After outrage over the claim in Kerala and demands for a ban, the trailer was modified to say that the film was really about three women. The film was released on the 5th of May. It's been criticized as another film that vilifies the Muslim community and furthers a communal narrative ahead of state and national elections. Political parties in Kerala have claimed the film is a political one. However, campaigning in Karnataka ahead of state polls, Prime Minister Narendra Modi referred to the film.
ये केरला स्टोरी की इन दिनों काफी चर्चा है। कहते हैं केरला स्टोरी सिर्फ एक राज्य में हुई आतंकवादियों की छद्म नीतियों की साजिशों पर आधारित है।
However, even if the numbers are overstated, the film is based on the story of multiple women from the state of Kerala who did convert to Islam and joined Islamic State. While some of the Indians who joined the terror group were killed, some of them were arrested when Islamic State collapsed. News site StratNews Global accessed interviews with some of these women and it's available on YouTube.
We came here expecting an Islamic life. To live under Islamic law, but many things were not up to our expectations.
In today's episode, we take a look at Islamic State and India and just how much the terror group managed to spread its influence here. For that, we spoke with Kabir Taneja, who is a fellow with the Strategic Studies Program at the think tank Observer Research Foundation and is the author of the book The ISIS Peril. Just a note, we spoke a day before the release of the film. Kabir talks about why the number of people who joined Islamic State is far lower than some narrative state. He also explains why the ideology of Islamic State never caught on in the country and why India, like many other nations, has made little attempt to bring back people who joined Islamic State.
What do we know about Indians who went to the Middle East to join IS, and you know, what are more accurate estimates that we do have?
There are two ways of how you see this number. The first one is, of course, even by government estimates that were released a couple of years back from the Home Ministry, the exact number is obviously not known. It's very difficult to ascertain. But the estimate always been between like 180 to 250 or somewhere in the middle of that range. So definitely not in the thousands. And even from our personal research, the estimate is actually very similar to the government one, which was between 150 to 200. So that's a realistic take. Now, there is a gray area here that there are a number of Indians that do live in or have been living in the Middle East for a long period of time. The population is over 7.5 million in the larger Gulf region. Now, how many have joined from there directly and what happened to them, whether they came back, becomes more of a local issue for those particular countries where they live in rather than India. So that number we don't know, at least publicly.
So do we know what happened to the bulk of these people? Is there a certain trend that we know with them, or is it as vague as the numbers themselves?
All kinds of eventualities happened. We do know that some joined the sort of the fighting cadre of the Islamic State between 2014 and 2016, which was when it was the most prevalent in Syria and Iraq. And we know some also died, you know, fighting for the Islamic State. Some were captured. They are in prisons or maybe in various prisons that are not necessarily under a particular state's control. In Afghanistan, we know that a couple of people were imprisoned. Some of them were even interviewed by an Indian portal, Strat News, I think. And when the Taliban came into power in August 21, they opened all the prisons. So beyond that, they clearly were let go. But what happened to them is remains unclear, right? And there are some other cases where, you know, they actually came back. You know, their story became a counter-narrative of sort from the government side. That, look, they went, they joined this terror group and they were ill-treated. They were racially abused. I don't know if you remember, there used to be these stories of they were made to clean toilets or fix Wi-Fis and stuff like that. And which is a possibility because, you know, that is a level of sort of racial division does exist in the Middle East as well. So they also see, you know, where the cadre is coming from. A whole amalgamation of eventualities happened. Some came back. Some came back very quietly because they were captured by states in the Middle East and they told India, look, just take your people back. We will not make a hue and cry about it. They were brought back. They were put through the judicial system. A lot of them were let go because of lack of evidence. There's no sort of linear way or method on how this played out. It was very patchy and different strategies were applied.
So, you spoke of these interviews that were done by Strat News post the release from prisons and things like that. Specifically, the women who spoke in those interviews, they spoke of, you know, being sort of stateless, left unclear, in a sort of limbo in a way. What do we know of them anymore?
We knew that they were in prison up till August 21. After that, most prisons were opened up by the Taliban to let their fighters out, which constituted most number of people in Afghan prisons at that point of time. But with them, you know, all these other people also were let free. So I at least I personally don't know what became of these couple of people, mostly women, who were part of this interview that was aired. There are prisons in Syria as well right now where there are over 30,000 pro-Islamic State fighters and ideologues, you know, under guard. And they are being taken sort of care of by no state, but by the local militias that are working with the US and other countries and making sure that these guys don't make a dash for it. And that's how, you know, this is all being handled. It doesn't come out much in the public, or it's not in news per se right now, but you know, there is no international system on how to deal with these people who had joined the Islamic State. There's no sort of sure shot way of how this is being handled. So a lot of these people are still where they had traveled to and are stateless and will probably remain stateless for some time.
Kabir says a lot of propaganda targeting future recruits wasn't as much about the fighting as it was about living in an ideal Islamic State. He explains how radical groups like Islamic State are careful about how and when they target people.
The whole sort of lifestyle thing part was marketed separately. The ideology was marketed separately. The ideology was at the core of it. Always has to be at the core of it. Without that, it doesn't function. But if you see the kind of, you know, big video productions they did, you know, the kind of glossy magazines they released where they showed that, look, how they're building this quasi-state, there'll be housing, there'll be... I mean, if you go and see the interview of these women in Afghanistan, they said, like, look, even after our husbands were killed, they took care of us. You know, we got food, we got a job, or we got housing or whatever, or money to take care of the kids and so on and so forth. So almost like a social welfare system was created for them under a certain understanding of Sharia and purist Islam, which was very attractive to a lot of these people. There have been cases where people have joined the Islamic State after conversion because of personal tragedies, where let's say someone's very young child passed away because of an illness, and that was seen as an entry point by some local person to say, like, look, you will find much more peace if you convert and you do this and you do that and so on and so forth. And then it snowballs into other things. I understand that there is this need that there has to be a point of singularity where all this convenes and makes sense when it comes to radicalization and promoting radicalization. It really doesn't. They're very smart in how they do things. They're cognizant of the situations that exist politically, socially, where they can enter and sort of market their viewpoints, right? And they have been doing this fairly successfully. The first issue of the pro-Islamic State magazine called South Al Hind, which was targeted at India to radicalize Indian Muslims, was launched at the same month when the Delhi riots were taking place. And you could see it's a very hurriedly produced publication. But they saw this opportunity that this communal thing is taking place right now. This is where we need to enter. This is the best time to sort of, you know, hit the hammer when the iron is hot. They're not stupid. They're very well aware of these kind of things. And that is how a lot of their radicalization worked, not just about in India, but in Europe, for example, where a small country like Belgium had twice the number of cases that India does.
So you also point to this fact that it failed to take root in India, the radicalization. Why did it find so little acceptance here compared to, say, Europe?
So first and foremost, look, I think the advent of Islam in European society is fairly new. A lot of the European countries are still working on issues such as assimilation. While in India, it's been centuries since Islam has been here. It's been a long time. It has had that assimilation. There is a level of comfort between society. They have experience of living next to each other, despite partition being a spoiler in the middle. European countries didn't have this. So they have a much more ghettoized society. Even we do at certain level, but they have a much more ghettoized society where there are places, for example, in Brussels, which are known to be where most of these pro-Islamic State cases came from, because less jobs, could not identify themselves as Belgians. In Indian Muslims, they do identify themselves as Indians. It's very sort of almost sort of a given, but it's not so in most European countries. So a lot of these people, you know, especially in the 20s, men mostly, found this sort of idea that, you know, okay, fine, let's go live there, which seems to be a more Islamic society than what we have here, considering a lot of liberal secular societies is not something even their parents were comfortable with, right? So that never got inculcated, even while they were living in that kind of framework. So that's a much more complicated sort of thing that took place in Europe, but that is a part of the reason why we saw many more number cases coming from European states like France, Germany and Belgium than let's say India or Bangladesh.
I also wanted to talk about the hierarchy that you spoke of right at the beginning, where Indians sort of found themselves at that sort of lower end of the hierarchy. Do we know why that was the case?
I think one of the facts that they were expecting when they land in this, I mean, utopia they had created in their own minds, was that there is going to be a level of equity for them. But you have to remember that in places such as, let's say, the Middle East, even within Arab cultures and they see, okay, fine, you know, if we have a group like this, if it needs to have an hierarchy, it will come from places where first they have had that experience of pushing back, and second, where, you know, tribal backgrounds, sectarian backgrounds matter, right? So they are coming from backgrounds that they are much more comfortable with, they know much well, than say coming from South Asia. And that was not exclusive to Indians, I think. Even if the Pakistani goes there, not going to find the same equity within the hierarchies of a group like Islamic State than they would, let's say, if they join Lashkar or Jaish or something like that. But of course, you know, when you are getting radicalized either by someone or reading the propaganda or watching the propaganda and getting radicalized yourself, all that is not told to you. Like any good propaganda will not tell you the shortcomings or what you could expect there. How Islamic State was formed? Islamic State was formed out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had much more, you know, the leadership of Al-Qaeda in Iraq sort of fell out with Osama bin Laden, but they all came from the same clique. Now, if you're coming from outside and you say, I want to join the Islamic State, you're most welcome, but you're still not from that clique. So you will be given sort of odd jobs on the side, or you'll be told to fight. I remember there was one case where the Indian fellow was extremely upset that he really wanted to go there and fight. He wanted to be, you know, on the front lines. He wanted to do that for the group. But ultimately, he was told to be a water boy. So provide water to the fighters who are fighting in the front line. So if you see it from any aspect, that is at some level diminishing to your ego, right? Considering you have built that in your thing that I want to be a warrior. You don't get to do that. And there are multiple cases, especially of South Asian, Southeast Asian heritage. And of course, by the end of it, you know, I think most of them who wanted to fight did get their chance. The cadre of the Islamic State was also fairly diminished, to the point where they were even pushing women to take up weapons, which technically under their own rules is not allowed, but because they were really desperate. So most people who went even from this part of the world with the idea of fighting ultimately got it because of conditions. Not because the Islamic State hierarchy wanted them to be an equitable partner with what they are trying to do. A lot of this, at some level, in my opinion, also started to sort of act in itself as a counter-narrative to what Islamic State was propagating, which worked for, let's say, the security agencies and the government here.
In 2014, a group of men from Kalyan, a suburb in Mumbai, left their homes allegedly with the aim of joining Islamic State. One of them was believed to have been killed, only to return to India, allegedly with the help of Indian agencies. Kabir says the narratives of those who returned disillusioned from joining Islamic State were also used to dissuade others from pursuing similar plans.
And the entire narrative that was created and publicized all over was like, look, they were doing this, you know, they reached out and said, we want to come back. This is not what we expected. This is not what we wanted to do. They were mistreated and so on and so forth. So these kind of cases, as they came through, became counter narratives in themselves. At some level, they must have dissuaded others to say that, look, what you are thinking is a land of sort of opportunity for you theologically or ideologically is ultimately not.
Another major event that took place at the end of 2017 was that almost all the territory held by Islamic State had fallen. Kabir says this was also a major factor in dissuading others from joining the group and also from working for them in their home nations.
You know, 2018 onwards, we haven't really seen any new cases because the geography is not there. The geography was critical. The Islamic State said, you know, okay, fine, you know, leave that. Conduct an attack wherever you're living. People are like, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not of interest. And people literally just fall back into their normal lives. For a lot of people, they saw it as an escape, maybe. For a lot of people, they were ideologically inclined towards it.
But even when it came to this sort of coming together to form attacks in India, you write about how there were attempts to do that as well, where to form sort of cells, yeah, which other terror groups have been successful in doing in India. But again, Islamic State wasn't able to do that. What explains that?
The two biggest terror attacks attributed to the Islamic State, now whether they were directly involved in it or not is anyone's guess, was Dhaka 2016 and Sri Lanka 2019. The Sri Lanka one is still very vague of whether the ISIS was even involved or not, you know, because they take claim of anything and everything under the sun, as long as it sort of furthers their agenda and narrative. All the major attacks in India, whether it's 2001 against the parliament, 2611 Mumbai, Pulwama, all these things, you need resources. You cannot conduct this without training. You cannot conduct this without money. You cannot conduct this without equipment. And groups that are working in other states, you know, unless there is a significant backing of financing or another state is backing, it doesn't work out. You're literally telling someone who's telling you, let's say as an Islamic State recruiter, I want to come and join the Islamic State in Iraq. And you said, no, it's not really possible right now. We are down for the count at this point of time when it comes to holding territory. Why don't you spend 1 lakh rupees, buy, let's say, explosives and make an IED and conduct an attack there? That person will be like, where do I get the 1 lakh rupees from? I'm not spending from my own pocket for this. And even if that thought comes, they would... The very thought of their sort of positioning in society, their family and all, comes in the middle. So they start thinking twice or thrice if there is no sort of help to it. that is one of the reasons we've had cases. You're right, we've had cases, we've had cells that have been busted, we've had cells that have gone to training in forest to try and come up with a plan to conduct attacks. These cells were being sort of handled from outside using social media and the internet, but they had a lot of infighting because the ISIS handler would say, okay, X, ABC will become the chief of the cell. The others will be like, why? You know, why would he be? Why would not I be the chief? Or why would I not? There are charge sheets that we have studied where you can see the Islamic State handler getting frustrated because these guys would not align hierarchically to what they are saying. Right? They'll say, okay, this guy knows how to handle money. Let him be the treasurer for this operation. The other guys would be like, but why? Why him? We don't want to give our money to this guy. You know, so a lot of these, you know, cases never happened in India because the people who were getting radicalized were not coming from ideological indoctrination. They were getting radicalized like on the go. They didn't go and join the Islamic State at the age of 8, where the only thing they were taught was that you, by the age of 25, you must conduct a fidayeen attack and that will give you paradise or whatever it is. That kind of indoctrination didn't happen. These guys are watching stuff online. These guys are reading stuff online. At some level, somewhere in their chemistry, it was like, yes, this makes sense to me. I want to try and act on it. Their idea of acting, again, going back to thing, was that I want to go join this. While the other side is saying, no, you conduct an attack wherever you are. So that was a disconnect to begin with. And over that, you know, they tried to make them into cells. They tried to make people who are running shops, who don't have any background in this kind of indoctrination, and telling them, you spend your own money and your resources to conduct an attack in some obscure part of India, which may work, may not work, no one knows. The kind of radicalization that took place was actually in India, specifically in majority of the cases, was very, very pedestrian, which is why most of them got caught. Whether through, a lot of them were given up their by their families and ecosystems. Local police systems eventually found out that these guys are talking about this kind of ideology with other people. And the other people will go and tell the cops, they're like, look, why? Because in India, the beat cop system is actually very good. Most beat cops are from your local communities. So they didn't have an issue of going to the cop and telling, look, this guy is talking like this, why don't you have a word? And usually, you know, that person would not get arrested. And we never actually had, thankfully, any major attacks that were attributed to this song. All major attacks in terrorism that are in India, that have taken place in India, have largely come from the cross-border terror groups that operate out of Pakistan.
And when it comes to these people who were freed from Afghan jails, are sort of missing, or even if we know where they are, what's India's record in terms of bringing them back? Because you spoke of these people who went to state agencies and said, we want to come back. They were brought back.
Yeah.
There were some cases of people arrested.
Yeah.
But there are people, like you said, who've kind of fallen between the cracks. What is India's stand on them?
India doesn't have an official stand on it, right? It's a case-to-case basis. Like I said, those Kalyan boys were actively sort of brought back. Like, there was help given to them to come back, and a counter-narrative was created. The problem is that when you bring them back, and you put them through the legal system, the legal system will ask for guarantees and proof that the security system cannot provide. For example, the one of the Kalyan cases, he went through the judicial system, 8 years in the legal system. At the end of it, he was given bail. Why? Just because they literally ran out of the maximum number of time you can be kept under that system till proof is provided. Let's say the Taliban opened the jails in 2021. One of the other core concerns for Indians is that a lot of the IS people in Afghanistan were in touch with Pakistanis. Right? Now, whether that Pakistani was just a radical, were they intelligence operatives? But they've been in contact with them. So we don't know the veracity of what they say. And even if you see the interview which is posted by Strat News years ago now, there's not a lot of remorse amongst the women. They don't seem very inclined to walk back on their radicalization. At least some of them, if I remember correctly. So how do you sell it to your population? Why are you bringing them back? They have joined the Islamic State by their own will. In India, there is no public push, and I don't think there is going to be any public push which says, "Nah, you should bring them back. They should go through the justice system." Some people may say that, but majority will not bother with it. They will say they made a decision. Let them be. If they're in Afghanistan, they'll figure it out. If they're in Syria, they'll figure it out. Let them be. If they die there, they took that decision themselves. So the government has no political pressure to act on it. And I have seen these interviews of the mothers of these women who've said that, you know, once they come back, they will not do this kind of things again and all. But that is, at least in some of the cases, being challenged by what the person on the other side is saying themselves. When they are saying that, actually, no, I don't think what we did was wrong at all. On what basis do you put them in the legal system? Because then the public perception or the public is going to ask the government that, why are you going beyond your call of duty to bring them back? And this is not a debate that is India specific. It is also the reason why Germany, France, and all these European countries could not bring them back. Now some of them have taken the women and children back because of pressure. But that pressure doesn't exist here. So the Indian government is not obliged to sort of go out of their way and seek them out.
So finally, then, how do you view something like this film that's now come out, which deals with a subject like radicalization, which is an important subject to talk about? Religious radicalization of any kind is worrisome. But it also comes at a time just ahead of a state election. It comes a year ahead of a national election, and obviously is then being termed as electoral propaganda.
So first and foremost, I've not seen the film. I think it releases tomorrow. So I can't really comment on what is the content of the film before seeing it. But having said that, the fact that if we start discussing these issues of radicalization from the pro-Islamic State cases that happened in places like Kerala and Karnataka and Tamil Nadu and others, from the point of view of domestic politics, social crevasses, political divisions here, that is precisely what propaganda of groups such as Islamic State aims to do. It works in their favor. If it's about radicalization and what happened and why did it happen, and it is thoroughly done, for example, I mean, just for the benefit of your listeners, PBS did a very good documentary on the Taliban, which is available on YouTube. Now, if you see that, it is done as no sort of major aspects of American politics into it. It does at the end of it, because that's why the US left and so on and so forth. But it's not discussing what role did the Afghan Taliban played in elections in a state in the US. But if you make a story or make a film based on trying to tell what happened, why did it happen, then it's fine, you know, and those kind of films should be made because people need to know. It requires a level of nuance. So again, I've not seen this film, so I don't know if it actually exists or not. It needs to be handled with care if you're telling this kind of story. It needs to be factual. It needs to take from n number of research that has been done on this aspect for over the past 5-6 years globally, not just in India. If the only way you're going to see it is from a domestic political point of view, from the point of view of local issues, communal issues and stuff like that, then I think we are missing the larger picture, and we are giving more sort of oxygen to the propaganda that we are trying to suppress in itself.
Kabir says that while it's important to examine radicalization, the fact that Islamic State is another radical ideology that failed to take root in India is something that needs to be highlighted more.
The highlight from an Indian point of view is that this is not the first time where number of radicalization cases that many would have expected to be in much higher in number never happened. When the Mujahideen were fighting against the Soviet Union, it's not like the Indians suddenly, you know, got up and flocked away. Considering that, you know, the Taliban comes from the Deobandi school of thought. Deoband is like 100 kilometers from here. From where we are sitting. But that mass movement of people still didn't happen. So India has a history of this. It's not new. So I think one of the very important points to inculcate is that that yes, there should be no cases ideally, right? Even 200 is 200 too many. But India has a population of what, 250 million Muslims, out of which 200 cases are there. I'm sure there are some locally radicalized cases also. But the fact that India has historically not been that country which provides manpower to these kind of things shows once again in the past 5 years when the Islamic State was on a juggernaut that another group, another movement, another radicalized ideology has failed in this country. And that should be highlighted.
Today's episode was produced by Jairaj Singh, Sunay Marathe and Anuja Singh. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We're available on TY Plus, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts and all other platforms of your choice. For any news tips, email us at tuipodcast@timesinternet.in.